This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Nuclear talks, Snowmageddon, and Sarah Palin in the news this week. On the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Republic, Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad said his country is now a nuclear state.
In the nuclear field, you are aware of the nuclear progress, and today, due to the blessings of God, Iran is witnessing scientific progress.
Weather and weathermen both over the top in the mid-Atlantic blizzard. AccuWeather meteorologist Jim Kosick went nuts.
14 to 22 inches of snow! Blowing and drifting!
And Sarah Palin spoke to the Tea Party convention in Nashville over the weekend, mocking the message of hope and change.
Now, a year later, I got to ask those supporters of all that, how's that hopey, changey stuff working out for you?
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's moving your world this week? A new jobs bill, Tea Party buzz, global economic angst, a snowplow. You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Edward Luce, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Ed, welcome back.
Thanks. Hi, how are you?
Very well. With us from Bethesda, Maryland, still snowed in at home with his streets still not plowed, Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Ken, welcome back to you as well at home there, sir.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Ed, and Ken.
Let's dive straight in. Ed Luce, this jobs bill this week, we saw $150 billion or so put up by the House, then $85 billion. It looked like a bipartisan agreement, Republicans and Democrats in the Senate, and now we're told Harry Reid has got a $15 billion jobs bill. You can debate whether or not we should have one, but if you have one, that does not look like much, Ed.
Well, that's true. It's not going to have a huge impact on employment growth. But then, you know, to be honest, neither was the $85 billion bill, and neither was the $150 billion bill. So I think this was probably more a reflection of political calculations. The bipartisan bill that had been negotiated by Max Baucus in the Senate Finance Committee with his counterpart, Republican counterparts there, contained a lot of unrelated stuff that frankly smelt like pork barrel, special interests, politics as usual. And as we all know, the two parties can unite on not wanting to be accused of that nowadays. So I think Reid's measure was a sort of pure hard-boiled political pragmatism, as we might not be able to get a serious jobs bill that seriously affects employment, but at least we can avoid the kind of K Street allegations that come with these pieces of legislation.
Ken Walsh, how do you interpret what's going on here? We continue to hear this drumbeat of projections saying high unemployment will last a long time, out to 2015 potentially they're talking now. So in that context, a $15 billion bill is the best Congress can do to try and boost things up?
Well, this I think indicates the larger disarray really within the Democratic leadership and between the White House and Congress, because a lot of people in the White House felt that they were, you know, they were okay with the larger package, but Senator Reid decided that that wasn't going to work. It's also an indication of disarray between Harry Reid, the Democratic majority leader, and Max Baucus, the Finance Committee chairman. There's a lot of Democrats who are unhappy with Baucus for reaching out for so long to the Republicans on the health care issue, only to have it fail to get any Republican votes at all. So there's a lot of really confusion in the Democratic Party as to where they go on a lot of these issues, and I think this whole jobs bill has been an example of that.
Let's hear from the president. Here he was on Tuesday talking about the need to get a new jobs bill through Congress.
I think there's some ideas on both the Republican and Democrat side that allow us to potentially, for example, lower rates for small businesses on their taxes to help spur on some growth. And my hope is that both in the House and the Senate we'll see some packages moving over the next several weeks that can provide a jump start to hiring and start lowering the unemployment rate.
There was the hope, and there was talk about bipartisanship. Ed Luce says it was, a stuffed turkey of a bill. Harry Reid was talking about it yesterday at a news conference and went after the Republicans, even as he eventually brought out his own very narrow $15 billion bill.
The provision dealing with highways saves 1 million jobs. So the Republicans, I don't know in logic what they could say to oppose this. But we've seen since Obama was elected, they have opposed everything. They're the party of no.
They're the party of no, but they weren't talking that way. Senate Minority Leader Republican Mitch McConnell said at a news conference yesterday, still talking about the two parties finding agreement on a jobs bill.
We're certainly open to it, and there's a chance that we could move this forward on a bipartisan basis. We hope it's not just another stimulus bill. We hope it is truly a job generator. We know that wasn't a job generator. But I think there's a chance the Senate could get there with a small package.
Jack Beatty, what do you see going on here? We've got a big unemployment problem in this country. Here's what Congress has in response. Harry Reid, ultimately, a $15 billion bill.
Yeah, as the New York Times today calls it, a pathetic gesture, given the scope of the problem. The scope? 14 million unemployed Americans. And as you say, the White House's own budget projections, they project unemployment 10% pretty much for the rest of this year. When you compare what's going on to what, say, the response of the Roosevelt administration to unemployment, really, what a dramatic contrast. According to a study this week from Northeastern, topmost people in our earning among American earners, unemployment among them is 3%, or it was last quarter. Among those earning $12,000 and less, it's a staggering 30%, which is higher by 5 points than the average during the Great Depression. In the winter of 1933-34, Harry Hopkins at the WPA put 3 million Americans to work in 90 days. Because of the need, because so many people were hurting. And here we have 30% unemployment among the poorest Americans and this pathetic gesture. And by the way, those people, those low earners, by over 20 points, they voted for Barack Obama. And it appears from Barack Obama and the Democratic Party, all they're getting is, more unemployment.
Let's turn to another front in the legislative world. Health care. Ed Luce, Barack Obama's going to sit down and talk with Republicans about health care, hash it all out, he says. But what about a bill? Is there still any chance? Are Democrats still hopeful, or is it just talk at this point?
I think there's still some hope. Obviously, it's a great deal less than it was a few weeks ago. It'll be interesting to see next week's recess, President's Day recess for Congress. So everybody's already home in their districts and states for the next 10 days. It'll be interesting to see whether legislators, including Republican legislators like Judd Gregg from New Hampshire, will return to D.C. in any different frame of mind at all, because most people see the bipartisan televised summit that the president's going to hold in Blair House as more of a political gesture than a really substantive step towards getting this enacted. I'd say there's probably, you ask people here what chances there are of a comprehensive health bill being enacted this year, you get responses like a 1 in 10 chance or at best a 1 in 5 chance. So it'll be very interesting to see if that mood shifts over the next 10 days as legislators interact with their constituencies.
Here's John Boehner, a Republican minority leader in the House from Ohio, on Fox News Wednesday night, saying he was looking for results on health care reform but hadn't yet decided whether to attend the proposed summit at the end of the month.
I want to have this bipartisan conversation, but I want it to be productive and I want it to be real. I don't want to walk into some trap. I don't want to walk into some political event. I want to walk in and have a real conversation about what we can do to make this our current system work better.
Really? Really? We don't know. Let's get our listeners in here. Andrew in Montreal. Andrew, you're on the air.
I think the media has this opportunity to discuss health care with any Canadian they see, whether it was the the conference about Haiti in Montreal. Ask any Canadian, the cop, the border guard, the guy cleaning the streets, the unemployed guy. I don't think people lack motivation because they have socialized medicine. It works. It works great. Minnesota, Canada. Ask the reporters on the street. Have them ask socialized medicine, government paying for it, whatever you want to call it. It works great, whether you're working or not.
So go to Vancouver and just ask around. Andrew, thanks for that call. Ken Walsh, I mean, there are interesting things happening here. Billy Towson, former congressman, was one of the highest paid lobbyists in Washington as head of pharma, the pharmaceutical industry trade group. Now he's stepping down there. He's under fire for having cut the deal to cooperate on health care reform in return for it not costing his industry more than $80 billion over 10 years. Now he's out of there. I mean, are things just turning in a whole new direction, Ken?
Well, a lot of the hope that the year started off with, not only on healthcare but in so many other things, is fading. The Tozan situation is a good example of that. A lot of the pharmaceutical company leaders feel he did sort of give away too much, and they're not happy with how that's worked. But on this issue of the February 25th so-called summit on healthcare, mm-hmm. the televised summit we've just been discussing, you know, when you have somebody like Boehner talk about this being a trap or an ambush, you hear that a lot among the Republicans, and they're concerned that President Obama is going to bring them in, and he's very good at these sort of outreach moments personally, and that they'll look like they're obstructionists. But you know, we have to remember also that a lot of their constituents, particularly in these House districts, are very much Republican for the Republican members. So they don't have a lot of political threat for standing up to President Obama and for torpedoing health care that looks like it's in this big spending, big government category. So I don't think that this is going to be a very positive moment. I think that what you might get is sort of dueling arguments, and the country sort of declaring a pox on both houses, thinking, well, these guys can't be trusted. We don't know what to believe.
And off we go with health care unreformed and rates going up 39% from one firm in California. Ken Walsh, Ed Luce, Jack Beatty, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Looking at a week in the news, Iranians in the streets, Palin at the podium, a skinny new jobs bill light in snowy Washington, with Ken Walsh, chief White House correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, and Ed Luce, Washington bureau chief for the Financial Times. Jack Beatty's here as well, and we've got a lot of callers. Dave in Des Moines, Iowa. Dave, you're on the air.
Hello, folks. I'm a vet, unemployed, voted for Barack, still have a veterans for Obama bumper sticker on my car, but in this nasty Midwest weather, it's peeling rapidly.
Uh-oh.
I think they've lost the game. Personally, I think the Democrats are acting extremely cowardly. The Republicans have them on the run, and they smell blood, so they're not going to come to any kind of table. And just reaching out the way Barack seems to be doing, constantly with no results, in my mind is approaching insanity. They want to stomp him. I don't know if it's racism in the country. It certainly feels like that out here, kind of like what did you expect from a black man? And it's awful,
wow.
But it's real, and everybody is entrenched and just running for the hills, and I don't know why, because we supposedly have the power. But what they're going to set this up for is riots in the streets, because people are getting so desperate out here. It's bad. They're, you know, more and more homeless, less and less medical care. Someday, at some point, people will wake up and take back whatever's left of this country if it hasn't been given away to the Chinese. Take my answer off the air.
Thank you very much, Dave. Ken Walsh, let me come first to you. I mean, talk about stepping down to disillusionment. There it is, though. You can hear what Dave was hoping for. What's going on here, Ken?
Well, you know, you could. There's so many threads that Dave's call raises here in the more political and social life now. One is the White House has been trying to build its case that they're reaching out. You know, there was a case this week where he finally met with the news media at a news conference after not having done it for 7 months. But they have a lot of ways they're trying to reach out to people, talking to the House Democrat, to the House Republicans,
YouTube, many in 160 some interviews, one-on-one with reporters and so on. But I think the impression that the caller raised is pretty widespread. Where does the outreach lead? I mean, where do we see the core of what President Obama will fight for? He's really caught in a lot of ways because a lot of people feel that this isn't the president they elected. Some people feel he was going to be more centrist, not more of a, as much of a big government person. Others feel that he should be more taking on the Republicans, you know, fighting for a bigger jobs bill and that sort of thing, you know, pushing back on health care a lot more. And you just saw in this past week four civil rights leaders at the White House. We were talking earlier, I think it was Jack who mentioned the soaring unemployment rates. In the black community alone, it's 18-20%. That's not even in some of the worst areas. So this is the depression level unemployment in the black community, but the leaders, including Al Sharpton and Benjamin Jealous of the NAACP and others, gave Obama a pass pretty much and said, well, we're not looking for sort of race-specific policies to help the African-American community, but still there's a lot of percolating concern on the Hill that, particularly among the African-American members, that he's not helping the people who need help the most, the poor African-Americans and so on. So he's really getting pulled in many different directions, but I think the overall pattern here is he needs to show the bottom line, where he, what he will fight for. And this is something we have not really known and still don't know in one case after another from President Obama.
Jack, there's a lot of talk about the narrative and where it stands and how strong it is, or maybe the lack of it. Our caller Dave says, you know, the Republicans have Obama on the run. On the other hand, I saw poll results this week saying Obama still tops Republicans in terms of public confidence in him. Where do you see the game, the narrative, Jack?
Well, I think he's been playing for that perception. The New York Times today reports that the public gives him higher marks for bipartisanship than the Republicans, that even Republican voters quoted in the article say, yeah, the party pretty much has been the party of no, and the president is making gestures. So he's getting political credit, it seems, for his reaching out. But I think he's also broadcasting weakness. You know, one begins to worry about a president when I'm reading in Ed Luce's column this week that Ben Nelson, of all people, the senator from Nebraska who held
up the sweetheart deal there.
Yeah, sweetheart deal from Nebraska to hold up the health care reform. Ben Nelson comes out and says the president needs to, quote, crack the whip among Democrats on that bill, that he's been too easy with them. And it raises the question, does President Obama really have the sand to be a great president? Does he have the stuff? You know, how do presidents with sand react when they want something? Well, here's LBJ calling Frederick Keppel, who was his commissioner of education during the desegregation. He would call him at all hours of the day and night and say, Fred, how many schools did you integrate today? 2 o'clock in the morning. How many schools did you integrate today, Fred? That's how a president who really wants something acts. And this president has not done that. He just retreats. He becomes passive. He looks for, you know, momentary advantages in the polls and loses sight of the fact that we are on the cusp. He is, his party is, of a reform they say they have wanted for 50 years.
I want to look at what's going on there, especially in his inner circle. Ed, you've been writing about that. Here's just a little bit of President Obama talking about what went wrong with the health care bill and his, in the context of hoping maybe to turn it around at the February 25th summit.
The public has soured on the process that they saw over the last year. I think that actually contaminates how they viewed the substance of the bills.
Ed Luce with the Financial Times in Washington, you've been writing about the president's very tight inner circle and how that comes into play, has come into play in shaping his image and the narrative and his push or lack thereof.
Yes, I mean the number of people that I've spoken to in Washington, both supporters and advisors to outside advisors to President Obama, who are concerned that he isn't drawing advice from a broad enough circle, is really very striking, which is why I decided to write about it. I think their concern isn't that there's some kind of a cabal or a Chicago mafia, as the caricature goes, but that the inner circle, namely Rahm Emanuel, David Axelrod, Valerie Jarrett, and Robert Gibbs, that the inner circle, with the exception of Rahm Emanuel, has carried straight over from the campaign a very successful campaign that provided no need to change the team that Senator Obama had brought Senator Obama to the White House, but which nevertheless has no governing experience. Now, this might sound like quite an esoteric point, but successful presidents tend to be able to manage the stream of policy advice they get separately from the stream of politics advice they get. And I think the concern of friends and advisors, outside advisors to the president, is that that stream is really being combined through this inner circle, and that he is reacting far too much in campaign mode at sort of short-term shifts in strategy. The Volcker rule, for example, on banks coming very quickly after the Massachusetts defeat. Three or four days later, the announcement of a domestic spending freeze, which, you know, caught Nancy Pelosi and others on the Hill completely unawares. These kinds of things are seen as a product of a campaign mentality rather than a more deeply rooted approach to governing. And I think that the concern is that if he's going to recalibrate his presidency, which all his friends and supporters ardently desire that he do, if he's going to successfully recalibrate it, that he needs to rethink the managerial structure in the White House.
And meanwhile, you've got the Tea Party in Nashville, Sarah Palin there, sort of taking on the fundamental themes of Obama's campaign at this point, going after hope and change. Wow, Steve in Buffalo, New York. Steve, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just thought that her speech, and it's particularly that part about how do you feel about that hopey changey stuff, it strikes me as very ironic, because the anger and the sentiment that I catch from Tea Party and people on the right is just this utter disillusionment with government and that government's not listening to them. And that's a lot of the same sentiment that I was catching in the run-up to the Iraq War, say. And this type of a sentiment that got Obama elected, just that they wanted someone who they thought connected with them and would listen to them.
But now it's on the other side, maybe, but it's not exactly standing up for hope and change. It certainly is the anger piece. Steve, thanks for calling. Let's hear that just one more time. Kind of just an incredible tone from she who would be president. Here's Sarah Palin at the Tea Party convention again in Nashville, playing with President Obama's campaign slogans.
How's that hopey, changey stuff working out for you?
Wow, Ken Walsh, is that a seller? That mocking tone in a potential candidate for president of the United States, is that a winner?
Well, we have dueling tones of mockery when we talk about Sarah Palin, because, of course, the other side, Robert Gibbs, sort of was making fun of her scrawling her talking points on the palm of her hand at the White House briefing this week, where he scrawled a couple of sort of generic, very simplistic words, hope and change, as if he couldn't remember them, just sort of mocking Sarah Palin.
But hers are pretty simple words, too. Was it energy and tax?
Right, exactly. Well, yeah, right, tax.
You got to write that down to remember that.
Right, exactly. And so I think this raises the question, is she up to, you know, being on the national stage? But I think so Sarah Palin, you know, is a compelling figure to a lot of people. I must say that a lot of times Republican leaders, George W. Bush and others, will attack the media for being critical, which Sarah Palin is doing, and that will rally conservatives to that leader, which George Bush found and that Sarah Palin finds. Now, she still has enormous problems in her public perception, but she just gets enormous amounts of attention for whatever she does. But I think this compelling nature of her personality, I think, indicates that the Republicans are looking for some kind of at least the conservative wing of the party is looking for some kind of a leader to pull them back into national prominence and to speak to their concerns. And The other thing I wanted to mention real quick is that this notion about the President Obama and governing that Ed was talking about, you can also pick up the exact opposite notion that he's paid too much attention to the Washington insiders. He's given over his legislative agenda to House Speaker Pelosi and to Democratic leader in the Senate, Reid. He's allowed Rahm Emanuel, a former congressman, to play the Washington game. And you hear from a lot of his ardent supporters and activists from the campaign saying he's lost track that he was the leader of a movement. He needs to go back to first principles and not play the Washington game, and to go back to the why he generated so much support from independents and young people and so on. So you're getting this tug of war here again on what to do, how to pressure Obama. But some of the people who are very active in his campaign are very disappointed because they feel he's played too much of the Washington game, and he needs to confront Washington, which they thought he was going to do.
We're looking at a week in the news and a president with a very big agenda. Let's hear from White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs. This was on Tuesday, sort of having some fun with Sarah Palin's notes on the palm of the hand.
As you saw during the presidential campaign, the entire... I wrote a few things down. I wrote eggs, milk, and bread. I crossed out bread just so I can make pancakes for Ethan if it snows. And then I wrote down hope and change just in case I forgot.
Robert Gibbs at the podium at the White House. Jack, what do you make of that, you know, hopey changey stuff now? Is that a seller in this? Is it sell the way George Bush kind of sold?
I can't believe it will. I mean, you know, it's hard to be against hope and change. I mean, what's the opposite? Hopelessness and stasis, paralysis. Sarah Palin's Tea Party speech was greeted by David Broder with a gushing column. He says she has a pitch-perfect mastery of the populist message. We have Joe Klein, a brilliant statement of her position. Well, these pundits seem to be it looks as if the public has it right and the pundits have it wrong. This week, 71% of people think she's unqualified to be president, including 52% of Republicans who now say this. And Republicans clearly see that a 2012 ticket headed by Sarah Palin would produce what Steve Schmidt, John McCain's campaign manager, called a catastrophic election result, simply because of the sort of numbers that you see. And, you know, this vision, 71% says she's unqualified. Here's page 397 of Game Change, the new book about the campaign. Quote, Palin couldn't explain why North and South Korea were separate nations. She didn't know what the Fed did. Asked to attack America on 9/11, she suggested it was Saddam Hussein. Asked to identify the enemy her son would be fighting in Iraq, she drew a blank. The blank is Sarah Palin.
This is when she was on the ticket as the vice presidential candidate.
Right, and I think one of the revelations that comes out of this book is just how frightened the McCain inner circle, perhaps even the candidate himself, became when they realized what they had done in nominating this, pleasant and perky, but really blank candidate to be vice president.
Ed Luce, what do you think? Joe Klein in Time says, she's offering the opposite of hope and change, despair and stasis.
I would, on a personal level, fully agree with that. And I have to say, again, on a personal level, was delighted to see that poll that Jack just cited this week, because it does show that the American public are, for the most part, paying attention to the lack of detail and the complete lack of grounding in Sarah Palin's political stances on things. And I think you see that if you watch her on Fox News as compared to giving a speech. I mean, she mocks the president's teleprompter style, but she gives a good speech written by other people. But when she's actually unscripted, getting questioned on air, she's absolutely clueless. She can't even think of a founding father, all of which is not what a neutral reporter should be saying. So I'd probably better shut up at this point.
But on the other hand, Joe says, her position could work for her. He says he's got a theory that Bill Clinton's philandering worked for him, a guy who, hung out with faded lounge singers and celebrated with double, quarter pounders at McDonald's. Palin, he writes, hits the same mystic chords as Clinton. What do you say, Ken?
Well, I think in the end, those personal things for Clinton, I think people were willing to forgive rather than embrace. I think it was his policies that people liked, so I have some disagreement with Joe on that. But I think that, you know, we can't lose sight of the idea that there are genuine grievances that a lot of these so-called Tea Party people have, independent of Sarah Palin. I don't think we can dismiss this notion of this concern or fear or anger in a segment of the country.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, a colorful congressman dead, Ellen on Idol, and the music of an era at the White House. Texas Congressman Charlie Wilson died Wednesday. He armed the Afghans against the Soviets. When the Russian tanks finally retreated, he toasted the Mujahideen.
Yeah, I watched Peter Jennings. I had a bottle of champagne I was saving for such an occasion, and I broke it open and gave them a little toast.
Comedian Ellen DeGeneres made her debut as a judge on American Idol this week. She had some advice for one auditioner who was a little over the top.
Don't frighten your audience. Don't get so intense, you know. Sexy and scary, it's a fine line.
And President Obama hosted a night of civil rights era music at the White House. Smokey Robinson, Dr. Bernice Johnson-Reagan of the Freedom Singers, Jennifer Hudson. Here's the finale.
Let every voice
big night, right there, big crowd. We're looking at a week in the news, Iranians in the streets, Palin at the podium, skinny new jobs bill. We're joined by Ken Walsh, Chief White House Correspondent for U.S. News and World Report, Ed Luce, Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Jack Beatty's here. Let's get a call from Sue in Des Moines. Sue, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
The point I wanted to make in my disillusionment with this administration is that, Obama really inherited a very failed government. And I'm an economist in Iowa, a health economist. And one of the things, one of the very simple points I'd like to make is, you know, the general public is unable to organize in its own best interest. And so the role of government is to do that. And I think the problem with the current administration, if they've been unable to do that, some of the important dialogue that might have resolved some of the market failures in health care would be things like getting away from employer-based health care. There has been no dialogue on that. And as far as Sarah Palin and the Republicans, they have no incentive to have to collaborate with this government or have any success. It really is just essentially a very failed system. So until we address market failures in health care, like employer-based health care in this country, we're not going to get anywhere.
So you don't want a more centrist President Obama, Sue, I guess. You would go for the more progressive Obama.
Well, it's just, if you think that it's more progressive to really think about the general public's interest and get away from what a lobby interest is, well, yeah, then that's what we're talking about.
Jack, what do you say to Sue?
Oh, it's so hard to get away, Sue, from the lobby interest. That's the problem. Look at the health care bill. You mentioned, Tom, that Billy Towson, the director of the drug lobby, had retired. In order to even get
former Louisiana congressman.
Yeah, former Louisiana congressman. In order to even to get on the board with health care reform, the administration cut a deal with Pharma, essentially saying, all right, you'll take this many cuts. You'll agree to take, $80 billion over 10 years in cuts on drugs, and in return, you guys won't advertise against us. And they made similar deals with the big hospital combines. Well, right away, of course, out of the gate, they're compromising away, if you will, some of the leverage that you have in a big reform bill, which is that you can say bargain drug prices down even further than $80 billion, or that you're able to do something more on hospitals or insurance companies. And the reason they made those deals is the reality of American politics. They didn't want to get clobbered with hundreds of millions of dollars in ads that could sink healthcare, as Harry and Louise and company helped to sink Clinton care. So the reality is, even a progressive president has to deal with the broken system he found, and in order to do that, he's got to compromise with these lobbies.
Let's go to Stratford, Vermont, and John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
A modest suggestion for actually getting some help on jobs and for communities. Why not take a chunk of money and reinstitute the old revenue sharing program? It's a Republican, old Republican program that gave money to towns and cities to spend as they felt needed. Very little bureaucracy involved, very effective, and just mandate that it be on new capital improvement. And every town, city, and school has a list of stuff they know that needs to be done. And this could create jobs immediately with little bureaucracy.
John, let us pick it up. Ken Walsh, of course, a lot of stimulus money went to states and on down. There won't be so much of that looking forward, but there are a lot of jobs that are right there. Is there a revenue sharing possibility here? Is there revenue to share, Ken?
Well, that's the problem with a with deficits exceeding $1 trillion a year now. I think the feeling is, well, you know, we've shot this ammunition a couple of times now, and you just have to hope it works down the line. But I think revenue sharing is in the, you know, it's certainly still in the mix among a lot of people in Capitol Hill. Some people at the White House like that approach. But then you get to the details. When you give money to the state and local governments, then they might want to have projects that are more camera ready or that people will see, and that maybe that would involve saving fewer teachers and building more roads that people can see. Now, is that that may help the construction industry, but what does that do for other areas of the economy? So there's drawbacks for every one of these proposals. What the President Obama and Democrats in Congress tried to do was have a little of everything. And but to the point of sort of where this all goes, I think that there's still a tremendous effort to get into this job creation much more. And I think that's really where the focus will be. And there's a lot of argument that President Obama did not get into this soon enough, that he was focused on health care for too long. You know, I'll let the listeners decide, you know, which of those arguments is true. But I think there's no doubt that health care is now fading in Washington, in the Washington sort of climate, and that job creation is increasing. But if you get the kind of the thing that happened this week with, as we started off talking at the top, where Harry Reid cuts back the job creation bill, there's just not a lot of agreement on where this all should go. And that's part of what's got so many people riled up. Why can't Washington get its act together? But the country's divided, and so is Washington.
Let's go to Jewett City, Connecticut, and Chris. Hi, Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. One of the problems here is no matter what we do, we're going to increase the deficit. And that's a time bomb waiting to blow up. It's going to give China control unless the American people wake up. President Obama got elected saying he was going to change Washington. Well, he was either crazy or whatever. He's a politician. He said what America wants. That's what Sarah Palin is. Somebody's got to get up and call everybody's bluff. He should have said, the hell with all these million-dollar ads. These people are nothing but greedy SOBs that are trying to steal your money, kill your grandmother. We already have rationed health care. It's done by the insurance companies. I'm going through it right now with myself, trying to get my insurance company to pay for a machine that will, because I have sleep apnea, that will create more problems as long as this goes on, but it's going to get more expensive in the long run.
Yep.
We need to, and American people need to understand, I make $15 an hour. To get out of this problem, you've got to tax me more. But by God, show me you're actually going to try to do something rather than keep on with the same old thing. They need to sit down, shut up, and say, okay, people, we're all a bunch of idiots. We're all responsible for this. Here's the solution. Let's put our arms up, just like we did during the Depression.
Chris, let us pick it up. Ed Luce, how about if there's one line of thinking that says President Obama's options may have narrowed here, given that time has passed, but the path for him now is to just get very, very honest with the American people about our circumstances and what it may take to move beyond them. Do you see that instinct in this president?
To some extent, I agree with the sort of dilemma portrayed by one or two earlier on, which is that, you know, he's now going to focus on jobs, although he's also going to try and get healthcare through. He's going to focus on jobs between now and November, but there's a very limited toolkit at his disposal, you know, given the reluctance of Congress to pass big spending measures. The opinion polls show rising public concern about the deficit. If he wanted to break through that and appeal over the heads of Congress and point out that more stimulus spending now could mean lower deficits, you know, in the next year or two, as many economists, probably most economists, would argue, you know, that would be a bold step. It would also be a more stimulus spending correctly targeted, and I think you know, to the states and even sub-state level is exactly the place it should go. That's where the most if you like pro-cyclical activity is taking place. In other words, that's where budget cuts are occurring at just the point when they shouldn't be occurring. That's where the recession is being deepened. Then that would be a bold move by the president, and it would win the applause of economists. It would probably, you know, make the whole deficit politics, Tea Party, backlash against Obama that much worse. It would therefore be a statesmanlike thing to do. Do I think he's going to do that? To be honest, I doubt it. I think he's instinctively a very reasonable person who likes to try and reach out and try and synthesize positions and build consensus. And I think that's what he's going to continue to try doing. I'm not sure whether it'll work any better for him over the next few months, though.
I want to look beyond U.S. borders for just a minute here. We've talked earlier in the week about what's going on in Europe with Greece and all the rest of the debt there. Also, a lot of noise this week, at the least, out of Iran. Here's a little tape of the Iranian president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, through a translator. Of course, he was talking this week about Iran becoming a nuclear state. Didn't exactly mean a nuclear-armed state. Nevertheless, he's talking here about how Iran will eventually break free of American influence.
They're struggling in a deadlock, in a stalemate situation, and hopefully the Western wing of the hegemonic system has come to its end, and God willing, in the near future, this inhuman malicious system will also collapse.
Ahmadinejad saying, we are going to get out of this deadlock with Western hegemony, talking there as Iran celebrated the 31st anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. Ken Walsh, a lot of talk from Secretary of Defense Robert Gates and others this week about sanctions. Are we moving in that direction quickly, slowly, inexorably? What do you see?
Yeah, I think we are moving in that direction. I think that, you know, as we've been saying, Obama trying to be reasonable, trying to get international conciliation, trying to actually, initially trying to be somewhat conciliatory toward the government of Iran, which has not been working. But I think you are going to see more of a move toward the sanctions. I think that this is something that we've been talking about now for a long time. But the government there is despite their own internal problems, and that's another whole subject for another show. Mm-hmm. Because
we'll talk about it on Monday right here. But yes,
right. Well, some people think that government is cracking because the insurgency against the government is gaining steam. But you know, others have a different view. But I think that certainly we're going to move toward more sanctions against Iran, and I think then you get into the whole question of who will go along with them. And that's always been the question.
Ed Luce, do you see Europe ready to get on board? What about Russia? What about China?
Well, China's the key here. I think Russia is probably closer to getting on board than it has been in a very long time. That's been one area that the Obama administration has made clear progress. China, though, is the key, and U.S.-China relations are at a very, very precarious stage at the moment. As you mentioned earlier, the president will be meeting the Dalai Lama next week. In Washington. He will not be the first president to have met the Dalai Lama, but he might well be the first to get a blowback this strong. The Chinese have been very, very incendiary in their language about this. So I think that's going to be a key part of the calculation, how China-U.S. relations proceed. And at the moment, China is a very, very skeptical on joining any UN Security Council actions against Iran. So it's you know, yet to be seen.
It will be a fascinating moment to watch world power, politics, and leverage playing out. Ken Walsh and Ed Luce, I want to thank each of you very much for being with us this hour. Ed, with the Financial Times there in Washington, thanks for joining us today, Ed.
Many thanks indeed for having me.
Ken Walsh with the U.S. News and World Report. Dig out there at home. Ken, stay warm. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Jack Beattie, stick with us for a minute here. I want to listen for just a moment. Listen back, I guess, would be the right way to put it. Yesterday marked the 20th anniversary of South African apartheid activist Nelson Mandela's release from prison. He spent 27 years behind bars. On February 11th, 1990, he walked free. Here's some tape where he spoke to a crowd in Cape Town on the day of his release, concluding his speech with words from his 1964 trial. He said the words were as true today as they were then.
I have fought against white domination. And I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. But if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die.
Listening back there to Nelson Mandela on the day of his release 20 years ago this week from 27 years in prison. Jack, in these times, it's still good to listen back to that voice still among us, still with us, of a man who paid such a price and was so principled in coming out with that message, you know, against white domination, against black domination, the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and equal opportunities. Boy, that's still, that flag, let's hold it high still today.
Indeed. Talk about hope and change. Hope and change for transfiguring leadership. I mean, in all of the 20th century, I can't think of another example of a leader who so completely transcended the lock of history. History looks like destiny. And then a leader comes along and says, no, it's not. It's not written. We can change. We can do better.
Jack Beattie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Here from the South African Parliament this week, as 91-year-old Mandela entered the room, members of the Parliament stood and paid homage to him. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.